I like simple metaphors. And so for today's topic of leadership and voices of the margins, I'm going to try one on you. I was thinking of a couple of us deciding to share an umbrella, a big one, big enough for all of us, maybe. Two of us would manage holding it, and so we would be necessarily the closest to the center. For the two of us, I imagine this would work perfectly well. Sun and rain would be consistently blocked. The few folks who are beyond the core two would be not faring quite as well, perhaps. I can imagine the folks would be as committed as the folks in the center, committed in the shared purpose, so they would gather around and try as best they could, but sooner or later, they would begin noticing and complaining amongst themselves how this wasn't working all that well. Someone might say something to me or you at the middle. At first, we might be shocked. We at the center are always striving, after all, to hold the umbrella as fairly as possible for all. We may even tilt the umbrella when there's a driving wind bringing rains from the north, tipping it to be most helpful. Why haven't we ever heard these complaints before, if you think we're doing such a terrible job? Hopefully, though, in a very, very short time, we could get over our egos and realize how much we do, in fact, care about this mission and about all the people. And perhaps we would talk just amongst ourselves at the center and say, well, I know what we can do for them. Let's get them rain bonnets or big floppy hats. That'll make them happy. We solved it. Yay, us! And so we do that until someone mentions to you or me, this still doesn't feel ideal. And we even kind of wonder why it is that you are always in the center. You did provide us with hats, that's functional enough. But now we're feeling singled out, treated less like members and more like problems to be solved. Now what? As we begin looking at leadership, I share first with you my core belief: we're all already leaders. We are in the stories of our own lives. When we come together, organizing ourselves in families of choice, we bring a sense of personal leadership into the mix. Sometimes we find ourselves in a maze, a structure of necessity that calls for certain types of leadership. We have to sort out, where do our talents fit? Do they? Are our dreams still being recognized and honored? I couldn't talk about leadership without also talking about meetings. And I'm going to tell you something that I have not yet found that it's all that popular of a personal view. I love meetings. I do. I love meetings. They are like family gatherings. I get to spend time with people I care about. And unlike family gatherings, I'm guaranteed everyone that comes to that meeting cares about the stuff I care about. And that's why they're there. We're motivated to work together on our common goals. So this meeting we heard about in the reading, thank you, Mark, this reading was a product of lots of meetings. It was Freedom Summer, 1964. African American activists were setting up those schools, educating Black Mississippi Americans, and registering them to vote. It was grueling work. It was life-endangering work with the murders of two white allies and one Black activist hovering over them as a constant reminder of just how risky this endeavor really was. the Democratic National Convention was being called to task as black voters demanded legal integrated representation. So much was going on. I love to imagine being at that meeting. Demographics of leadership were shifting. And no, Ella Baker was not the first choice or even the second choice for that meeting. Old school models of leadership called for the best practices of having a big name keynote speaker, someone already credible to a wide audience. But Ms. Baker was accustomed to this, and she had already stepped in to speak wherever she could, whenever she was asked. And she also, having been on the margins at the meeting that the day in her life that's described in the reading, she was watching who's in the room and noting who had put in the legwork and the hours and put their lives on the line, who had done all that work. It wasn't established leadership. It was all the young people coming around. And it wasn't until they had reached a critical mass that then established leaders or some folks with more experience looked and thought, hey, we really got something going here. And they want to take ownership of it. Ella Baker was there to say, no, it is in fact the stories of the folks that have had their lives on the line that matter the most. We don't need eloquence. We need truth. So we have this example, don't we, of long-established leadership. And I, right along with most folks, consider it the right way of doing things. It calls for clear organization, clear hierarchy. Who's responsible for what tasks? Who answers to whom? Where's the accountability? Who makes final decisions? This is why this way values experience. It values formal education and eloquent speech. If this sounds familiar, it should, because this model is very much in place all around us in faith communities, nonprofits, and throughout corporate America. This formal structure is hierarchical, and so it's easily, neatly represented in graphs. Who likes neat, pretty graphs? I do. So taking this fellowship, for example, you have an elected board who contracted with me to serve as your minister. And then the board oversees finances, mission and vision, and appoints committee chairs, who then in turn seek committee members who collectively do their part of the work, which we can call shared ministry. And as needed, reports are then given back to the board with questions or needs. This model can get complex as an organization grows, but with little time, most of us can sit and look at it and figure it out. But what happened in 1964? Grassroots movements are not neat and tidy, not easily displayed in a graph. To establishment, surely the Freedom Summer must have been shocking and even terrifying. Young adults without experience were organizing themselves. Black Americans were carefully developing an organization that was integrated, but they were taking applications from white folks who would be members, choosing only those who both shared the vision, that's a given, but who also would check themselves and be willing not to fall into the pattern of stepping up, used to being in charge as the dominant race in the nation. And instead, they would be willing to even do the most menial of tasks to support the common cause. Education mattered less, personal experience mattered more. This leadership model is more organic in nature, and it arises at the beginning of things. The beginning of a new organization, for instance. We can imagine this fellowship, when it first began, was a handful of people with similar values and principles who knew of Unitarian Universalism, first Unitarianism and then the merger, and they came together, oh, we should meet. This is so lovely. We should raise our kids together. We should educate our kids together and go on from there. So this model, this organic, inspired at the beginning of things model is absolutely fine and has its place. It emerges also in response to oppression. It emerges also in response to a disparity of power and of resources that reach a boiling point and charge people to take matters into their own hands. It's a messy process, and I think it's an energizing process as well that gathers momentum as its members push relentlessly toward their prize. So some say the flat model, the organic model, is unsustainable in the long run. If whatever the original short-term goal gets met, maybe the group, having achieved their goal, will disappear. Or for work to be ongoing, such as a fellowship, a handful of folks will go about structuring itself more formally. And there's some wisdom in this. In more recent times, we can look at the Occupy Wall Street movement. It excited the 99%, yet was so broad in scope as to be unsustainable. It was a movement with a start and an end. The romantic goal of giving voice to every person was replicated in city after city across the United States. Some of my fond memories are Occupy Gary. And you did it here too, I see. That's wonderful. We were under the U.S. Steel Mill on nice little property. It was theirs, but they had made it very green and lovely for the community. This protest or collective of protests would yield some good and certainly raised a lot of awareness, but it still is referred to in the past tense. On the other hand, what do you think of the Black Lives Matter movement? Is it done? Okay. What happened with it, it's a movement, and it was a broad movement started by just a few women. But what it yielded to, what it produced, was the Black Lives Matter organization. It's an internationally structured organization comprised of decentralized chapters. That's a broad shift from this idea of having to have an organization that has a hierarchical structure and somebody way at the top is, and it works its way down through the group. And this gives us a hint of possible hybrids for organizing leadership. Historically, in religions and in politics, we can see the cycle repeated. People organize themselves neatly. It works sort of well, depending on who we ask. But then, like our umbrella story, it fails some too. A few folks from the margins gather, and they shine a light on the shortcomings. Things get messy and chaotic. They settle down again, and with some amount of time, maybe some change happens as a result, and the process can repeat itself. Another thing we can say about the way groups organize themselves, their leadership, is that a certain personality, a group personality, emerges. The established group begins to understand itself in terms of its structure. And be careful. What I like to remind myself, no matter how worthy the goals of any of us gathering and forming an organization, as soon as we have done that, as soon as we have formed and we've set this out, all these wonderful goals, there emerges to the top an unspoken number one rule. Do you know what it is? For the group to survive. And that works on our psyches, that this becomes the new thing. So even if we're activists and we're holding it so fiercely, we want to help with reproductive justice, right? Or we want to help with immigrant rights. If we really, really did it well, we might render ourselves completely unneeded. And that can work against us in quiet, subtle ways as we struggle to do this good work, and yet we still need to feel relevant. So an established group begins to understand itself and develop its own personality. And we begin to have, unspoken or spoken, sort of an expectation, right, of who's going to be in the room. We all too easily fall complacently into a worn path of doing the work as we've done before. And some of this is good. Some of this leaves room for improvement. Burnout among a small, tired handful of leaders happens. Members at large can begin to feel left out. They can be feeling unheard. And on paper, the structure is there, it looks fine. The business aspects are managed same as ever. But we can feel it sometimes, that a heaviness, like a fatigue, settles in. All of this then suggests a few things to me. For a group to launch, sure, bring on the fiery passion of the grassroots movement style. It is key. The passionate energy and the commitment to the group's objectives helps us move forward. For that group to last, however, we do need the formal structure. And if I am saying that from a place of lack of imagination, being grounded in the model that I am used to, please tell me. Open my eyes to other ways of doing this. Not glamorous, nothing to write home about. This tried and true method of having something in place helps make decisions. How are budgets going to be created, managed, sustained? Who's responsible for turning the lights off at the end of the service? Do we know? We probably know. We have that covered. For Unitarian Universalists, the reason for existing at all has been to sustain space for every person to hear and to be heard, to seek solutions to societal ills, and to explore and develop their own questions and answers to life's biggest questions. And so as UUs, we also structure ourselves for sustainability over time. But even with our values and our principles, we open ourselves to the same ills of any group that falls into a rut of doing business as usual. We need both models or a hybrid at work. Maybe the ideal is to have a formal structure that also intentionally takes on as one of its tasks, nurturing space for the informal structure to thrive. In our Unitarian Universalist Association, the national level, leadership is wrestling with these same concerns. Being a product of the West, of Western philosophy and theology, our UUA, of course, nothing to be ashamed of course, reflects both the best and the worst of the larger culture from which it emerges. What happens in the wider society happens parallel in our and any organization. structured formally with an elected president and a board and bylaws and policies. There is generally an appreciation for the order and the clarity. And it leaves us wide open for justified criticism, for upheaval as the personality of the leadership gets challenged. This is happened and is ongoing as those of us who hold one or more multiple marginalized identities lift up the disparities that are witnessed and experienced. And just as in the wider community, of course, core leadership responds, and it gets messy. And egos flare, and tempers too, and feelings are hurt, disagreements erupt. It's unnerving to watch, it's rattling to engage in. And in my opinion, it is absolutely beautiful. It truly is. We come together as people sharing common principles and values, and we do so caring enough to come to the table and argue and cry. And ultimately, if we can stay, we hear each other out and we find new ways forward. I find it breathtakingly beautiful. Core leadership, in the best scenarios, will shift, becoming more representative of the diversity of the whole. So this messiness will hurt sometimes for all involved. When I tune into the arguments of the UUA, I think I get some of all perspectives. Using that umbrella metaphor, people who are being offered second thought fixes understandably can feel resentful, unappreciated, less than. Likewise, folks who thought that they think of everything will feel the same way, resentful, unappreciated, and less than. But it takes everyone staying at the task, dreaming up hybrids of these different models, trusting that we do care, giving one another the benefit of the doubt, and passionately supporting one another. My hope for us here is that we take lessons from the past, from the ongoing struggles, and work for a leadership model that feels right for this fellowship, that is strong and flexible and resilient, and above all else, open to all who would enter and share in the work. Blessed be.